Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. On the other line is Dan, and tonight we are joined by a special guest. He's a friend of the podcast. You've heard him on here recently before Big East play started to break down some Big East stuff and whatever else he wants to throw out there. And so we brought him back tonight to do the same since we're at the midway point of the Big East season. It's, of course, Doug Tift. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, let's jump right into it. Xavier, big week for the Musketeers. Won two games. They went on the road, won against a top 10 opponent in Providence early in the week, then came back Saturday and beat DePaul on the road in convincing fashion by 21. We'll start with the Providence game here first. And, guys, I think the biggest takeaway, it's what I wrote about after the game, was JP's shot. And we were on TV tonight on Channel 12 recording the Sports Authority, and Chad Brendel brought up Ali Farouk Manesh from Northern Iowa back in the tournament. I thought that was a great comparison. It's that shot summed up JP Makura as a player and this team, I think, too, and the way they play so perfectly.
Now, Farouk Manesh's was crazier. Because didn't need to shoot, and it was like a one-point game, and there were like 15 seconds left in an NCAA tournament game. But I see where he's coming from with that. What I thought was even maybe more significant than the Makura shot in that Providence game was the fact that Xavier weathered two. So they go to a place, and I actually was listening. You know, I don't want to plug another podcast, but I was listening to the NBC Sports podcast earlier today, Rob Dowser's podcast.
Yeah, plug it. I love Rob. Good dude. Thing.
Yeah, he was talking about this game, and he and Matt Norlander, who was a guest, were talking about how the dunk at Providence is apparently like a really crazy venue for college basketball. Like, the fans up there get really into those games. And in this game, on two occasions, Xavier had big-time adversity going. You know, the Providence seemed to have the crowd behind him. They were creating turnovers. The first was early in the game when the Xavier had a 7-0 lead. It was erased on a 13-0 run by Providence, where Chris Dunn, I think, scored every single basket on a run out after a lazy pass. Maybe that's just how it seemed to me.
No, it felt that way, yeah.
And then Xavier was able to weather that, and they were able to get the game back to tied at 20, and then they went on a run of their own. In the second half, Xavier led by as many as 17 points, I think with about 11 minutes left. They looked like they were going to cruise. And then all of a sudden, Providence, who couldn't hit water from a boat for most of the game, all of a sudden hit a couple threes in a row. They got moving downhill. Dunn makes a couple big plays, and then it gets to 3 points. And then JP hits that shot, and Xavier ices it at the line. So there was an example of Xavier facing two big-time runs from a very good team on the road and weathering that storm. And it was a little bit more pronounced, but I think it's something that they've been doing all year. Because if you think back, and Doug, you're probably at this game, but the Michigan game earlier in the year, when Xavier kept getting up to about a 9 or 10 point lead in the second half, and then would absorb runs from Michigan that would bring it down to a one possession game, and every time would have an answer. The same is true of the Cincinnati game, where they're up 16 at halftime, they give up a 10-0 run coming out of halftime, and they just ride the storm out, and they just see it out. I think in the Butler game, Butler made a nice run in the second half to take it from 12 or 14 points to 3 points, and Xavier just did not panic. They rode it out. They never got behind, and they just took care of business. So I think that's been kind of a defining characteristic of this team all year is their resiliency. And I think what that comes back to, Rick, is what you were talking about in terms of their confidence.
Yeah, I think so. Doug, let me ask you this. Do you think, with what Dan's talking about on being able to curb other teams' momentum and end those runs, is it more about Xavier's ability, like the fact that you can't stop Xavier's offense consistently enough to keep that run going? They're not going to go on a 5 or 7 minute drought like we saw at times last year? Or is it more about their ability on the defense to get stops and keep you from maybe you went on a 2 or 3 minute stretch where you were on a run, but you didn't score 14 points during that stretch. You only scored 7 because Xavier's able to get some stops even when they're struggling on the offensive end. What do you think is the bigger key there for X?
It was funny when Dan was talking, I was thinking about the defensive end, just the way that Xavier rebounds. And it's a great way to stop a run like that if you you think of so many times the backbreaker in a run. You know, team goes on a 7-0 run or something like that, and you can stop it if you get it. If you get one defensive rebound, but give up an offensive board, and all of a sudden now it's a 9-0 run or 10-0 run or something like that, and the place is going crazy. But that doesn't seem to happen as much with Xavier, just because of Farr and Reynolds. But on the offensive end too, you watch games like the other day. You watch LSU. The LSU Oklahoma game, or you watch some other games from around the country, you realize sometimes they're just teams that struggle to score for long stretches just because they have streaky shooters, or because they have guys that they just can't throw into the post and play out of the post. Where Xavier can play different styles, and they can play fast, they can play a half court game, and yeah, I think that's another reason why if they have to adapt to the way that the game is going, they're able to get themselves out of the little rut.
Yeah, I think that's what I was getting at with the offense. It's like you can't take away, even when you're really good at certain things, like Providence was. You know, you mentioned Chris Dunn getting in the passing lanes and taking off on live ball turnovers with runouts, and that's great. But at the end of the day, like, you still have to be able to stop Xavier in the post. Stop Xavier, not foul Xavier, which they do a great job of drawing fouls. Defend the perimeter. Like, you know, you can take away certain things and apply pressure in certain ways, but typically they're not vulnerable enough to completely cave to that, and they're going to find another way to beat your defense eventually. And I think Chris Mack and his staff deserve a lot of credit for this as well, because they do a great job of whether it's calling a timeout and drawing up a set play, or just switching up, you know, what they're running on the offensive end. They have so many different sort of offensive flow games that they run now that they can really do a lot of different things, and they have such versatile personnel that it's just really difficult to take away everything they do offensively. Doug, did you have any other significant takeaways from the Providence game?
Overall, I think it was just impressive, like kind of what Dan was saying, where you're able to absorb that kind of a run. This isn't Xavier related, but the other takeaway was that the new timeout rule is probably the dumbest thing I've seen in college basketball in quite some time. I mean, yeah, it helps. KP hits the shot, and it's great for Xavier, but that's pretty dumb that the head coach isn't able to call a timeout there. You think you saw it in the LSU game as well, where LSU is not able to call a timeout when they're, what is it, a three-point game, a tie game with 3 seconds left or something like that. It's shown up in a bunch of different games.
You don't like it at all. You don't like the new rule at all.
No, I mean, what's the point of it to get players to be more aware and to call timeouts, like an educational opportunity? I don't know. Why not just have a head coach do it rather than having a power forward who happens to be standing next to the ref, now he can call a timeout? It seems kind of dumb to me.
I get what you're saying. Like, I don't think there's a good point to this. Yeah, like, what are you doing, trying to teach them more responsibility or something? I don't know. But I have to say, I kind of enjoy it, just because it is creating some endings, like JP launching a three that was ill-advised but burying it. Or, you know, like you mentioned, it was just kind of crazy there in that LSU game at the end. Teams aren't able to sometimes call a timeout and set up what they want to set up. And, you know, sometimes that's going to work out terribly for them, and sometimes it's going to work out great for them, like it did for Xavier. So I think it adds a little excitement, and I've kind of enjoyed that, even though I completely see your point. There's really no reason to have this rule. Dan, what's your take on the new rule? Do you like it or no?
I think in a larger sense, I think anything that takes away from the micromanagement of college basketball games from the bench is a good thing, although maybe implemented in a way that kind of is counterproductive. But I don't really have a problem with the rule. I kind of hope they would go all the way to and it may be too much change, maybe something they need to do incrementally, but I wouldn't have a problem if they went all the way to the international rule and you could only call a timeout of the dead ball. I prefer the game to have a little bit, to have as much flow as possible, I guess. And the problem in college, obviously, is that guys would panic and there would be all kinds of craziness, but I don't think it's that particular rule has diminished my enjoyment of college basketball this year. And for that LSU game, I mean, I think when your coach manages to have the best player in college basketball maybe take 7 field goals in a critical game. maybe yeah, less timeout is a good thing for them. But going back to the Providence game, Rick. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Rick and I were talking about that yesterday, saying that John Jones should have been fired on the spot, Lane Kiffin style, before he left the court.
Immediately.
Ridiculous.
I mean, I couldn't blame them. I think the big thing, the other big takeaway for me from the Providence game, Rick, was the was Jalen Reynolds showing up and having a huge game for the first time in what seems like a month, probably since the Butler game, actually. He had 15 points, 11 rebounds.
31 minutes.
He turned the ball over quite a bit, but played 31 minutes, which was critical because James Farr got in foul trouble, fouled out in 18 minutes of play. Trayvon was in foul trouble. And obviously in a game like that, playing against a Providence team that can't shoot, that's one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the country, they were going to play a ton of 1-3-1 regardless. And Jalen is so perfect for the middle position in that 1-3-1, and to have him be effective on the offensive end, so you can keep him on the court the whole time, was big. Another guy I thought made big contributions in that game, who we've talked about Xavier needing more from, was Remy Abel, who hit 2 big threes during Xavier's run in the first half that created a lead that they would eventually ride out to the end of the game. But also played, I thought, pretty credible man-to-man defense against Chris Dunn. Obviously, you know, Dunn is going to, when Dunn gets 7 steals in a game, he's going to score a lot of points in transition, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it because he's a freight train in transition. But I thought Remy did a pretty credible job when they played man-to-man in that game. And then obviously, you know, he's the type of fundamental defender. He's got great court awareness, great length. He can be effective in a lot of different positions. So I thought his contributions were pretty important in that game, even if maybe he didn't fill up the stat sheet.
Yeah, I think the Jalen thing is huge, and that was obviously a huge topic of conversation on the message board, on this podcast, on the TV last week when I did that, was, you know, just his struggles and if he was going to get it going. And I mean, we had a whole thread on the message board about why he should be losing his minutes and who should be playing ahead of him and things like that. I think in the Providence game, he played really well and produced. In the DePaul game, he didn't play quite as many minutes and wasn't as productive, but I still thought he was really active and playing really hard when he was in the game. He kept his head, especially during that little stare down with the goon from DePaul, Joe Hanel, or however you say his last name, as Byron aptly described him, has no discernible basketball skills whatsoever.
Can I take off on this because I want to ask Doug a question?
Yes.
So that is the second guy that Byron has referred to as having no discernible basketball skills. So first question, Doug, do you remember who the first one was?
London Warren.
Is it an opposing player? I don't know.
Jimmy Binney.
Who was it?
Date.
Jimmy Binney, friend of.
So here's my question.
CJ Anderson.
Who is a better college basketball player? Who would you take, Jimmy Benji or Joe Hanel?
I'm going to pick Joe Hanel only because C.J. Anderson hates Jimmy Benji so much that if I said Jimmy Benji, C.J. is liable to track me down.
Well, here's the thing. The two of them couldn't be more incongruous because Hanel's got the floppy hair that he's checking at all times. And Benny kind of came out and kind of was, like, I think he was from rural Ohio somewhere. He always wore the humongous white T-shirt, probably had some sketchy tattoos. I would probably take Benny just because I think I saw him hit a 3 once, so I know he knows where the basket is. I'm not sure Hanel has any clue what's going on out there. But anyway, but let's talk about the DePaul.
You know, Jimmy Benny played for like 5 years in the NBDL.
Nice.
That doesn't make any sense.
He's a professional basketball player.
Hashtag nugget.
Okay. All right. I think that the talking point from the DePaul game is just that Xavier came out really flat. I mean, and DePaul was kind of on fire. They kind of played like a team with nothing to lose. You know, Rick, your boys were ready for the game. They were up for it. You know, they, I guess
this has gone so that has gone so far off the freaking rails.
They knew the respect that you were sending them, the dap that you were sending them through the internet. They knew that you had confidence in them and that they could really produce.
I picked them to lose by 13.
So they get out to a 9-0 run
at home.
But they win by they start out like 11-2 up. I think they had 5 of their first 6 field goals. Xavier was like 1 of their first 12. And then you know, something clicked there, and all of a sudden it seemed to happen so fast. The one thing, and we'll talk about this I guess next, but the one thing with this Xavier team is when they get on a roll, they just score like a million points, and they score it really, really fast. I mean, you think about the Wake Forest game where they came out of halftime 15 points down and were ahead by like the second TV timeout. Against Marquette, they were down like 9 or 10 points in the first half and then just blew their doors off before halftime. So you had some stats on this, Rick, that I think you wanted to hit on. But I thought that just showed like the runs that Xavier's capable of and the way they just kill the other team's spirit by doing that.
Well, and again, you know, you mentioned the offense, but then you go back to it, and a lot of those runs – they switched to the 1-3-1 defense, completely baffled the other team for 3 or 4 minutes, and that helps allow those runs. It's really both sides of the ball, I think, this year, even though clearly, you know, the offensive weapons, like you said, just allows them to get on these runs so quickly. CBS ran a great stat graphic during the game when Xavier was on a 15-1 run. They finished the first half on a 17-1 run, and then it continued into a 23-1 run in the first few minutes of the second half. But they put up a graphic that mentioned some of the games that you were talking about. December 8th against Wright State, Xavier had a 25-0 run in that game. November 29th, Advocare Invitational Finals, had a 21-0 run against Dayton. January 16th at Marquette, a 21-0 run. November 27th versus USC in the Advocare Invitational, a 17-0 run. December 22nd at Wake Forest, 21-4 run. Again, one you mentioned, Dan, and just amazing when you look at those runs, how they've completely, like you said, broken team spirits.
This game was 23-1, right?
Yeah, 23-1 in the second half. It was 17-1 to finish the first half, and then the next 2 minutes of the second half, they continued on a 6-0 to make it 23-1. So, yeah, that has definitely been something that jumped out to me. But, Dan, I thought the biggest takeaway for me from the DePaul game was, without a doubt, the play of Larry Austin. And I think I should address the C.J. Anderson situation because, Doug, you mentioned him coming after you. Clearly, he was not a fan of my tweeting during this game. So I had tweeted something about maximum Larry-ness, which I will explain in a second. But he said, WTF is maximum Larry-ness? I do not think he is fully on board with the lameness of my live game tweeting. But what I was getting at is Larry Austin, every day in practice, you would never know that Larry Austin is like the 9th or 10th guy on this team if you came to practice. You would think he's a starter. You would think he's the leader of the team. You would think he's the captain. He's the one who is constantly getting on, like yelling at guys, getting them into the right spots, doing everything that the coaches want them to do. He plays every play way too hard when other guys are like, dude, you know, come on, we got a game in 2 days. Like, We're trying to get through this drill. He's the one bumping into him, slamming into him, being annoying as hell. Very much. I know, Doug, you covered the team while Dante Jackson was there. Tell me, I love Dante Jackson, still have a relationship with him, think he's a great player and an even better person. But you tell me if I'm wrong. I think the best way to describe Dante Jackson during a Xavier basketball practice is annoying.
Yeah, annoying, loud, or waiting to be punched in the face.
Right.
Any of them would work.
And this is Larry. Like, that's Larry 100% of the time. Always, you know, he does, like, start scraps among teammates because guys get so annoyed with how he plays and how hard he's playing and the effort. And he has so much confidence every day in practice. And I've never seen him play like that on the court yet in a real game. Like, he's always just looked a little frazzled, not quite. Even when he's played well, it's just been in small spurts where he's able to get out in transition or something. I've never seen him be able to run through the offense multiple times in a row, just running it with the confidence that he shows every day in practice, being so active at both ends of the court, annoying the other team, being loud. You know, he was making weird noises to tell his teammates that he was open when he was coming down the court in transition for three, which I don't know what he was planning on doing with the ball once he caught it there, but he was letting them know he was there. And the one time he pump faked the three, drove around, pull up over Ghazi. I mean, really just the type of stuff we've seen from him in practice, but have never even come close to seeing in a game. And I look at that and you just think, if you can add basically a Dante Jackson-like player who may not – and Dante was a little bit more of an offensive threat on that team because he needed to be. But let's be honest, like, Dante was out there because of everything but his offense. It was all the intangible stuff, how hard he played on defense, how much he wanted to win. All of those types of things is why Dante was on the court. And – Larry Austin can be that exact same way. Now, it's tougher to get minutes on this team because of how talented and deep they are as just that type of role player. But if you can add that type of guy who has that type of confidence, can be a lockdown defender at multiple guard spots, and understands what the coaches want all the time, playing the right way all the time, I think that would be a really nice boost, particularly if you would run into something where, let's be honest, Edmund Sumner has not proven to be the most durable player so far in his young career, and he clearly needs to add some weight and bulk. But if he were to get injured again, God forbid, or if something happened to Miles Davis where you didn't have that secondary ball handler, or primary ball handler rather, Larry having confidence and playing like he did against DePaul would be huge for this team down the stretch if they had to rely on him.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that, and you know, I think that Larry's got that. He's just he's the guy that just wants to drive everybody to get better in practice, and certainly for guys that are 4 months into a season who've been dealing with him in practice every day, it's got to be a little bit grating. But you know, he comes into the game and he does bring energy, and I know that, like, in the Providence game, he made some bad decisions. His first spell in the game against DePaul, he had a bad turnover when he came into the game. But, you know, when he's out there, he runs the team pretty well. It would be nice, obviously, if he had any ability to shoot from the outside. I think pretty soon teams are going to start treating him like London Warren and sticking another guy in the paint every time he's got the ball, and maybe his ability to slash to the basket and finish will be compromised a little bit. But it's basically what we've talked about the whole time. If Larry Austin's your backup point guard, that's pretty good. I mean, there's a lot of teams that would really like to have a player of Larry Austin's ability coming off the bench at point guard. Heck, Georgetown might like to start.
One quick thing on that, Dan. Besides the fact that I don't know what Dayton did to you today, but man, taking some shots at Dayton. Looking at the second half when Larry played 13 minutes in the second half, and then Remy played 12 minutes beside him, and JP played 12 minutes as well. So that was your three guards essentially for most of the second half. Between the three of them, for the entire game, they fired up 1-3. So if you're going to play a lineup that has Larry a point guard for an extended period of time, you're essentially going away from the way that Xavier's play. You know, Xavier's firing up 23 pointers a game for most of the season. But if you're committing to playing Larry 10 to 15 minutes a game rather than 5 to 10, then all of a sudden you're kind of changing the complexion of your offense. Is that kind of what you meant?
Yeah, exactly. I think it really changes the complexion of the team. And so maybe the solution to that is they need to find ways, like if they're going to use Larry, you know, maybe if they're going to give Larry extended minutes, maybe you want to get him out there with some more guys that can knock down the three. Maybe you want Larry and Miles on the court at the same time in those situations, or at least one of Trayvon, JP, and Miles on the court so you have a three-point outlet. But I think it's a pretty minor problem. But, you know, one of the things that I think this game, again, proved.
Dan, real quick, can I jump in on the Larry stuff? I did like, you mentioned just the lineups mixing and matching. I did like at the end of the game, Mac put Larry in with Edmund at the two and used Edmund kind of how they were using Samaje and D together. And that's very much how I kind of see those two guys, you know, Larry being more of a D role where maybe his aren't, you know, the occasional three that D would take, but maybe his is the occasional slash to the basket where the postman finds him out of a double team, which he did twice against DePaul, or, you know, like a pull-up jumper, like he shot over Ghazi, which was a really nice move, or drive all the way to the rim. He's a good finisher, big, strong, and athletic. So I did like the look with him and Edmund in the game together. Edmund can stretch the floor enough. You can play, you know, two more shooters with all the guys that Xavier have at the three and the four if you want in that lineup. But the combination of Ed and Larry gives you two really athletic, guys who can defend and do some more things, put a little more pressure on opposing backcourts that you wouldn't have when you have a lineup that includes, you know, like Miles Davis, athletically speaking, or on the other side of that, obviously you couldn't play Remy and Larry together to get those two athletes in there because you'd lose everything offensively. But him and Edmund in there together, I thought was a really, really good look for this team. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
One more observation, then we'll move on to our Big East midterm report. So in the DePaul game, all 11 scholarship players that are eligible played, and every one of them scored a basket, which, you know, is kind of a meaningless statistic. It's sort of just an odd. But when you think about this year, I think in previous years when you and I would talk about, you know, what are the five biggest baskets that this team's hit this year? What are the 10 biggest shots that they've had? And it seemed like in previous years you would pretty much have one guy that dominated that list. You know, Samaje hit 8 out of the 10 or something like that.
Right.
And this team, when you think about it, when you for almost every one of those guys, you can think of a huge – every one of the main contributors, you can think of a moment where they made a huge play to either put Xavier on the road to victory or stop a big run or something like that. So, like, you know, you can just think of James Farr hitting that take he had against Marquette toward the end of that game when it got down to a two-possession game. Sean O'Mara had a huge basket late in the game against Providence when X was in terrible foul trouble and was kind of having to piece together lineups. You know, so many of these guys, Trayvon, obviously, I think that goes without saying, but it just is remarkable. Edmund's take against UC when that game got close. So there's just all these angles to this team, and you can't kind of go into a game and say, well, if we can stop Trayvon Blewett, we're good. That just is not an option. And that, I think, is what's serving Xavier so well, at least thus far in the season. And they're going to need to continue that. They're going to need to hit the three at a little bit higher rate, I feel like, because after this week, you know, the road gets really tough with those last seven Big East games. And with that, let's move into sort of the topic du jour today, which is we're halfway through the Big East schedule. Xavier's sitting second at 7-2 behind Villanova, who's 8-1, one game ahead of Providence and Georgetown, who are a game behind at 6-3, and then the rest follow. How do you guys want to deal with this? Do we want to talk about sort of midway all league teams first? Do we want to talk about sort of who's up, who's down? Where do we see the NCAA tournament picture being?
Yeah, let's start with the big picture view on the teams. And obviously, you know, Doug watches the Big East like no one else I know. So I always like getting his opinion on these types of things. Doug, just looking at where things set up currently in the conference, obviously Villanova at the top, 8-1, Xavier 7-2. Then you got Providence, Georgetown, both at 6-3, Seton Hall and Creighton, both at 5-4, Marquette's 4-5, Butler's 3-6, DePaul 1-8. St. John's 0-9, bringing up the rear. Biggest surprise to you out of that group is who and why?
Butler is probably the biggest surprise to me.
Absolutely.
They've lost some games. They lost some games they really shouldn't have. Like the Marquette game the other day, they just get the luck of the draw. Henry Ellenson, you know, he's going to have two or three games a year because he's so talented where he just goes off and goes nuts. He goes for 32-10 the other day and just destroys them, not to mention Tracy Carter couldn't miss, which for most of the season, the story has been that Tracy Carter can't find the basket at all. But
right.
All of a sudden, Tracy Carter, I think he knocked in 5 threes in that game. So it's just one of those games from hell that they've gotten a couple of those so far. But they're 3-6 right now. And just looking at the schedule, it's not doesn't get too much easier. They've actually had arguably in the same way that Xavier has had a pretty easy go of it through the first 9 games, and the second half is tough. Butler is kind of the same way. So they're gonna struggle to get to 500 at 9-9. A lot's going to have to go right for them to go even 6-3 the second half of the schedule.
Yeah, no question. Just looking at some of these other teams, I think one for me coming into the season, like once we got through non-conference, we knew Providence was pretty good. But coming into the season, I didn't know. I didn't think Chris Dunn had enough around them. I didn't think they would be, you know, a top 10 team in the country and up at this top tier in the conference with Villanova and Xavier possibly, or at least in that very next tier with Georgetown, Seton Hall, and Creighton. So I think Providence is a little bit of a surprise, at least from going back to the beginning of the season. Dan, is there any team that's really stood out to you as we, you know, have gotten halfway through Big East play here?
Well, I was going to say Butler, but I'll take one from the positive side. And we actually talked about this the last time, so I won't repeat myself too much. But Seton Hall, they're only 5-4 right now, but their remaining Big East schedule is on the manageable end of what's out there in this conference. And they are coming into a stretch over the next 10 days where they have a three-game homestand against Marquette, Georgetown, and Butler, which are all games that, quite frankly, they should win. That at Creighton game last night was one of the tougher games remaining on their schedule. They went into Omaha and really just kind of dominated that game from tap to buzzer. If they get through these next three games, and they're sitting at 8-4. You know, they've got a lot of their last four road games. Two of them are at St. John's and DePaul, two games that they very easily could win. And they've got home games against Providence and Xavier. I mean, 11-7, 12-6, not out of the question for this team. And I think, given what they did in non-conference, which, you know, they've got the win over Wichita State, which looks better and better the further we go. They don't have a huge number of sort of name wins, but I think that's a team that could sneak into the NCAA tournament picture, maybe at the expense of a team like Butler that's kind of got knocked around here on the quote-unquote front nine of the Big Ten, of the Big East.
Yeah, I personally think Butler is screwed. I agree with you, Dan, because here's the thing. I think this conference is going to get, no question, four and quite possibly five teams into the tournament when everything's all said and done with and all this shakes out. It's a huge bubble, but all of these Big East teams have so many opportunities for quality wins because of the strength of the conference and the depth of the conference this year that I think we'll end up looking at four, maybe five teams getting in. Doug, let me ask you this. We talked about Xavier, you know, currently being 7-2. Dan and I talked about this last week on the podcast of how many losses they would finish with and where that would kind of put them, what we expected. Where are you at? 7-2? What does Xavier finish in conference, do you think, and where does that leave them in the scope of the conference standings?
So I'd mapped it out, and I had Xavier overall 13-5 finishing up, so that would be 6-3 down the stretch. I didn't say exactly who they would lose to, but there's six games, and you figure they win three and lose three out of home versus Villanova, home versus Providence, and then at Creighton, at Butler, at Seton Hall, and at Georgetown. And so I think you say the Nova game is probably the toughest, even though it's at home, and the game at Georgetown is one probably should win, but seeing the way that Georgetown played when they came to Cincinnati, who knows? So I'd say getting out of those six games, 3-3 would be pretty good. And that leaves you 13-5 in the conference. I think that's probably good enough for second place.
Who else do you have up there? I mean, I'm assuming Villanova you have finishing first above them with just a couple losses. Maybe, and then who you have kind of right there with them.
I'd put Villanova first. I'd say 15-3, but the only way Villanova loses three games would be if they lose at Providence here in another couple days, and then at Xavier. There's really no other games. They should be 10-point favorites in almost every other game the rest of the way. And then I'd put Providence third at 13-5, and then Seton Hall 11-7 in fourth. I put Georgetown fifth at 10-8. I put Creighton and Butler both at 9-9. They're in the 6-7 spots. And then Marquette 7-11. DePaul 3-5 in ninth place. And then the St. John's Red Storm with a strong 0-18 showing for Chris Mullen.
Let me ask you about Creighton real quick, because that's one team I think I'm a little bit higher on than you are, but I haven't really mapped this out as well. Did you feel that they have a really tough slate down the stretch to finish?
Yeah, Creighton's got reasonably tough slate, tougher than a lot of other schools in that bunch in there. Georgetown's got a really tough schedule coming down the stretch, but Creighton they have at Villanova, they have home against Xavier, they go to Marquette, to Butler, and then they go on the road to Providence, and then they go on the road to Xavier. So it's pretty tough sledding. Really the only kind of gimme games in there. They have home games against DePaul, Marquette, and St. John's. So you figure there's three easy wins in there, but still, I'd say five. I put them at 4-5 on the back nine here, and I think I could see them going 5-4, but even that is optimistic.
Dan, we had kind of talked already about, you know, a lot of that stuff, how Xavier finished the season and expectations, whether that's a disappointment or not. Let me ask you this. Aside from the Villanova game, with Villanova coming to Xavier, you can't use that one. What's the next biggest game for Xavier, the toughest game, I should say?
I'm torn. Part of me says Providence at home, because Providence is 4-0 on the road in the Big East so far this season, maybe even 5-0, and I believe they're undefeated on the road this season. For whatever reason, they've been a team that's been dominant in road games and has struggled to win games at home. They kind of have the old reverse split. And I think maybe it's – I get the idea that they're a team that has a – with Dunn, with Bentel, you know, they're a team that has a lot of, like, for lack of a better word, swagger. Like, they're a very loose team. They're sort of I think they embrace that kind of us against the world mentality, and they really relish the idea of sending 10,000 people home unhappy. So that's an opportunity. But the other one, I'm going to say Butler away. And I know it's a terrible matchup for Butler, and I know that the Brian Snows of the world would say that it's sort of a 99 out of 100 situation. But you have to considering the context of that game, which probably is that it's going to be Butler hanging on to their NCAA tournament lives by a thread, absolutely needing that game. I could see that being just a really suffocating atmosphere up at Hinkle Fieldhouse in a couple weeks. And I would say that probably would be the Providence and at Butler would be the two that would concern me the most. I think Xavier can beat Georgetown. I don't think Georgetown really is that tough of an environment generally. And then at Seton Hall, obviously, is another tough game as well. Seton Hall and Creighton. I mean, just all the road trips in this league, once you get beyond that bottom three, are really, really tough. And I'm not even sure that going to Marquette is really that easy. So, you know, I mean, there's a couple different games, but as Doug says, you would like to think Xavier can win half of these tough games, and then if they do that, they're going to be solidly in second place. If they do better than that, maybe they can get into a situation where when Villanova comes here, it's a game that's for a tie for the league title, or maybe even to put Xavier ahead outright. So we'll see. But yeah, Providence at home, Butler away.
That's interesting, because I actually agree with your reasoning on both those. I think you bring up some good points, but those I would definitely have probably three other games ahead of those two, with the, I think at Creighton is a tougher game, and I'm going more off of matchups. I just think the 1-3-1 just completely kills Providence, and Xavier showed that when they go man to man, they can match up with them on Saturday. So on Tuesday rather, but Providence does not give me much concern for Xavier after seeing this past game. It was kind of what I expected going in, and the fact that Xavier looked even more impressive than I expected man to man makes me even more confident that they will easily win that game at home against Providence. And then the Butler thing again, I'm with Snow on this on the matchups thing, but I get what you're saying. What you look at this rivalry, you look at the fact that it's going to be a Super Bowl type atmosphere for Butler. The fans, you know, hate Xavier. It's going to be wild. I get all that. I don't think Butler has any way of stopping Xavier inside this year or beating him on the glass. I think Xavier rolls in that game. But, you know, at at Georgetown. I think Georgetown presented some matchup problems inside with their size. Xavier had trouble finishing. I don't think Georgetown will play nearly as well as they did at the Cintas Center in that game. So I do expect Xavier to win it. But to me, it's still a tougher game matchup wise. And then at Seton Hall, I think is a very difficult game. I think that would be a huge win if Xavier found a way to come out with a dub there. Doug, let's get into some individual stuff here. I think a lot of fans see the team names and see how teams are doing, but maybe aren't able to follow it as closely, the individuals who are sort of carrying those teams. So let's talk about where you kind of have these, the superlatives, the awards at the end of the year, where you're at right now on those, and where the Xavier guys would fit in, because obviously you've got Trayvon Blewett, you've got James Farr, should both definitely be getting All Big East consideration, and maybe even Edmund Sumner for the freshman list, things like that nature. So let's go Big East honors list, first team, who you got?
Okay. First team, I'd say Chris Dunn, hands down, unanimous player of the year. He's on the first team easily. Ben Bentil, also right there, leading the conference and scoring more than 20 points a game. And then Trayvon's on the first team, I would say. He's eighth in the league in scoring, and he's in the top 15 in rebounds, six and a half a game. And then Josh Hart from Villanova would probably be on the first team as well. He's over 15 points a game, and he's actually in the top 10 in rebounds, too, even though he's a guard. He's averaging 7.3 rebounds a game. And then the last spot, the fifth spot on the first team, I struggled with, but I penciled in Devontae Smith-Rivera. He's third in the league in scoring, more than 16 a game. He's got 4.4 assists per game, which is fifth in the league, and Georgetown is playing pretty well. So that rounded out my first team, but I'm open to argument on the last spot for DSR.
Well, I think that last spot is an interesting one. I haven't really maybe paid enough attention to this. How strict are they to keeping by positions? Like, do they try to do it traditional with, like, three backcourt players usually?
I think it changes every year. Like, the A-10 used to be – the A-10 would have, like, four point guards and then, like, a small forward. But I think the last couple of years they've at least had one big man in there, which that would be Bentil, I guess.
Yeah, well, like, is there a possibility? Because I'm just thinking about this, and I almost – I'm more impressed by the front court players – this year, after you get past Chris Dunn, I think, even the guys who are wings, like Trayvon, is playing the four this year. And then you look at, James Farr and Daniel Ochefu. Like, I think there are more big men with legitimate arguments for being, up there on these teams than maybe some of the guards do, who were, like, DSR, kind of expected to carry this team. Like, he's having a good year, stats-wise, don't get me wrong, but I don't know that he's, I don't know. I'm not huge on DSR and what he's done this season, but at the same time, I don't know that I have a better argument. Who else would be up for that spot? Like Ellinson, possibly?
I'll go through my second team. So the five guys on my second team are Henry Ellinson. He's over 16 points a game, which is fourth in the conference, and he's at 10 rebounds a game, which is leading the conference. And then Isaiah, so he'd be a good argument there for DSR spot.
Yeah.
Also in the second team, I've got Isaiah Whitehead. He's at 16 points a game, and he's 4.5 assists per game to go with 3 rebounds. And he's basically leading Seton Hall to like we said, pretty surprising season. Then Mo Watson, I had him in there. He's got 14 points a game and 6.5 assists per game, which is second in the conference behind. Right behind Chris Dunn. And then Ryan Arcidiacono, who's having a disappointing season, but still kind of almost like a Kobe Bryant type selection here. He's 12.5 points a game, which is still in top 15. He's only shooting at 34% from three, which is hurting his numbers a little bit. But he still has 4.2 assists per game, which is not too shabby. And then the last spot on my second team, I penciled in James Farr for that spot. Although James' numbers don't jump off the page at you. 10.6 points a game, which is barely inside the top 30. 8.8 rebounds per game is third in the conference. But I would say that the last spot on this second team would go to, in my opinion, would go to whoever wins the battle for being the best true center in the Big East. So there are four guys in contention for who's the best true center. I would say it's James Farr, it's Daniel Oshetu, it's Luke Fisher, and it's Angel Delgado from Eaton Hall. All of their numbers are pretty similar at the moment. But they're all right around 10 points a game, right around 8 rebounds a game. Delgado's a little higher than that, 9.9 rebounds per game. But you can take your pick out of any of the four of them and put them in that last spot there on that second team, in my opinion.
Yeah, I got a few things here. One, that James Farr spot is tough. I agree with you. I think it goes to one of those centers, but I tend to think if Villanova wins the conference, it's probably Ochefu who gets that spot. The other thing is the Arch pick. You're so right on this. Like, I'm a little concerned. Is there the pop? Like, I could see him being first team Big East just because. Like, he was co-Big East player of the year last year.
No, it's going to be a cheater type thing. If they win, if they dominate the second half of the league as well as they did the first half of the league, Arch is making the first team because the view is going to be he's the heart and soul of the best team in the league. It's sort of like
people love him.
You know, it's sort of an honorary thing.
And
also, keep in mind that Archie Diacono has another game against Xavier before this gets, and so you have to pencil him in for like 9 out of 10 from three and 35 points in that game. So that's gonna adjust his average up.
That's a good point. I think Arch really throws a wrench into these things when you're trying to fill out this list and figure out who the best guys are, because you know he's on there just regardless, and he probably doesn't deserve to be on either team, to be quite honest, but he's going to be on there, and I could see him doing first team. I really could, especially because we just talked about you kind of have a hard spot with that fifth spot. You know, I mean, DSR clearly has better numbers. I think my choice would be Ellenson for that. Like I said, I'm kind of more impressed with the big guys. I think you go Chris Dunn, and then you say basically Josh Hart, Blewett, Ellenson, and Bentel after that on the first team would be my choice. But, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Any other honorable mention names you want to throw out there, Doug?
Yeah, there's a bunch of honorable mention guys who would be in the mix. Like I mentioned, the other big guys, Oshifu, Fisher, and Delgado. And then I would say Billy Garrett has to be kind of the Billy Garrett Memorial honorable mention position, which I think he's gotten the last 2 years, and you can probably pencil him in for once again. And then all of the Butler guys, it's all three Butler guys who have good numbers. Rosie Jones, Kellen Dunham, that's fifth in the league in scoring. And then even Keelan Martin's arguably having the best season out of the three of those guys. So any of those guys, if they take off in the second half and really have a big game, against Baby or against somebody else, they could jump up into a second team position. And then the last guy would be, Rodney Bullock, who's quietly having a really good year for Providence, with more than 12 points a game and almost 7.5 rebounds a game.
Yeah, I think I'd have to take Rosie Jones. If it was just me picking the team, he would be like my Arch pick. That regardless of what the number said, I think I would have him at least on my second team over several of those guys just because I think he's ridiculously good.
I want to put Joe Hannell as an honorable mention for having the temerity to pick a fight with Jalen Reynolds. I think that showed a great deal of courage. Like, if there's a courage award in the Big East, he should get it.
Onions, double order, without question. All freshmen, you want to go there, Doug, real quick?
Sure. Pretty much no question. I think Ellenson is the freshman of the year, especially after what he did the other night, just absolutely torching and destroying Butler. Sumner was the freshman of the year as of 3 weeks ago, but I think the injury there was a bit of a factor and kind of set some distance between him and Ellenson, but still Sumner's right there on the freshman team. Tracy Carter is having a really good year.
He's playing better too. Assist.
Yeah, especially the other night. And then I think Yassini is in there just because he plays so much and he's going to have numbers. Got 12.5 points a game. He's shooting the ball all right. So I think he's maybe not the most talented guy, but Yassini will probably be there. And then the last two guys are the two Villanova guys. Brunson is probably there. He's at 10 points a game, almost 3 assists per game. And then Mikhail Bridges probably should be there as well. He's over 7 points a game, only 3 rebounds, which was actually surprising. I thought he would have more than that. But
But Bridges does so much defensively. Like, he's guarding the other team's best player a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, he's a freshman playing 20 minutes a game on the number two, number three team in the country. It's not bad.
Yeah, what do you think of those two Villanova freshmen? Because I'll be honest, like, Brunson's numbers aren't bad by any stretch of the imagination. He's a solid player, but I would think just with all the hype coming in, I've been a little, disappointed is probably the wrong word, but, like, to me, he's not quite living up to the hype, whereas Mikal Bridges, what I think he's been really impressive. I really like what he brings to the table. I think he's going to be great going forward.
I think you just described the Jalen Reynolds problem. Like, he's averaging 10 points and 7 rebounds a game, but I'm still disappointed in him.
Yeah,
I think it's the same.
You're right. You're right.
You can say the exact same thing about every Villanova fan and Jalen Brunson.
That's so true. You're right. I mean, the hype was too much coming in for a guy like Snow said. That's just not a great athlete, not great measurables, not a lights-out shooter. So it's probably a little too much hype coming in for him. He's having a great freshman season. I shouldn't take that away from him. But I will say I've been more impressed with what Bridges brings long-term. Dan, any thoughts you want to throw out there on all? We've kind of flown through this without you on the freshman stuff. Any thoughts you want to throw out there?
No, I mean, I think that's a pretty good summary of where things stand. I mean, there's nobody that I've seen that wasn't mentioned there. I think it's kind of interesting that in a season where Xavier's played as well as they have, they really only have maybe two guys. Although I'm a little bit less optimistic about Farr's. I think Farr will definitely be an honorable mention, but I don't know that he's making the second team. It's a little bit reminiscent of the year Stanley Burrell threw the fit because Xavier didn't get anybody on the first team, even though they probably had the six best guys in the league. But, you know, that's the way it goes. I mean, it's tough to make those teams because there's so many great players in this league. Who do you guys think, I know that Chris Mack has gotten some pub for National Coach of the Year at the midpoint. Who do you think is the Big East Coach of the Year at the midpoint?
Oh, man.
Him or Cooley. I'd give it to Mack,
yeah,
personally.
I think
Cooley, it's pretty hard to screw it up when you have the best point guard, you know, literally the best player in the country, all respect to Buddy Hield, but Chris Dunn's probably the best player in the country, especially on both ends of the court. And then you have Ben Bentel, who develops into an NBA player, and Rodney Bullock, who's pretty darn good. So, I mean, kind of hard to screw that one up, but I think Mack's done more, especially when you factor in recruiting. If you factor in recruiting into being a coach, then it has to be Mack, but most people don't do that.
I think I've got to go full Stu Gotts here because I called for him to get fired before the season started. I got to throw Willard's name out there. I thought Seton Hall was a complete dumpster fire last year, and who knows what was going on with that locker room. I thought that was going to be an interesting situation to follow, but they've impressed me. I think that he's got that thing rolling. That sophomore class is loaded. They're going to be good for the next couple years, and they're a little ahead of schedule already with, you know, 5-4 in the conference, 15-6 overall. They're playing pretty good basketball, so I don't think he would win it, but I think he deserves to be mentioned in that group. But to me, it's no question. It's Chris Mack.
Rick, I thought you were going to say Dave Lato the way you left the call, but yeah, you know, I guess that makes sense.
Good God, you guys.
By the way, it's kind of interesting because I think that probably I jock Providence more than anybody else, like as a non-Xavier Big East team. Is DePaul sort of the other team in the league that you kind of have a soft spot for, Rick? Is that what's coming out here?
No, that's what everyone's saying. I'm a DePaul fan just because I've, for the last 2 years, thought DePaul was much better than they apparently are. And, you know, I don't know what it is. Like, Snow and I talked about, they don't pass the ball well at all. I thought it was more coaching than anything last year. They have a new coaching staff. I think those guys are doing a pretty good job. I will say I don't think Billy Garrett has, like, gotten better necessarily over the last 2 years, so maybe that's part of it. But I don't know. I think DePaul's more talented. I loved watching Tommy Hamilton in AAU, first of all. A lot of those guys on that team I watched in AAU, I thought they did a good job of putting that team together, and they're terrible. So just don't hire me as an assistant coach to recruit for you, I guess, is the real lesson in all of this.
So you're telling me that in AAU ball, you liked a big fat dude that jacked threes.
Well, it wasn't just that he jacked threes, too. He would pump fake you on a bad closeout, drive into the lane, spin move, and finish with a finger roll because he couldn't get up to dunk. It was awesome. It was so great. And he was doing it as an eighth grader. Like, he was playing 17 and under as, like, a freshman or eighth grader. He was so young at the time.
Well, you're your love for the Blue Demons is unaccountable, and maybe someday they'll get back to like being respectable, and you'll be justified in all the positive things you've written about them. I think to a certain extent, what it boils down to is when you do your previews, when you look at those guys in isolation, you can talk yourself into DePaul having a lot of talent from an individual standpoint.
Yep.
It's kind of like how Seton Hall was last year. Like when you looked at those players, when you looked at a team that had Jaren Cena and that had Sterling Gibbs and that had Isaiah Whitehead.
But Sterling Gibbs was on that team. Like, and he's crazy. And that locker room was a dumpster fire. And that's
exactly.
Why Seton Hall's bad. But why is DePaul bad? We don't know that about them. Like, is that... I don't know. Is Dave Laidow just like everyone hate him or what?
I'm convinced that they do not practice at the same time. I think each of them comes in individually to practice.
Only individual workouts. Rick Carter's been doing nothing but individual workouts for the last 6 months and giving them Xavier set plays. That's all they've been doing.
Oh, Dan. Okay. Last question.
Dan,
for you guys. The dumbass play has now worked in 6 consecutive games. why does this work?
Because guys are worried about facing their men in this. Like, Xavier's the only team that does this to anyone, apparently. Like, no one else has thought to try to pull this off. But guys will just face guard their men every game of the year. So you can sit there as a coach and say, look, they're going to do this. You have to see the ball. But you get 13 minutes into the game and you've picked up a foul or two and you're pissed off at a ref and you're mad at Jalen Reynolds and JP Makira because they're being themselves. And now all of a sudden you forgot that you're supposed to see the ball in this specific inbounds play. And, you know, there you go, the dumbass play.
One different one, though, Rick. I think if I remember correctly, in the DePaul game, it happened in the first half, which means that it happened 15 feet from the DePaul bench. Wouldn't your boy Dave Laidow at least yell out, like, hey, you know, turn your head, or maybe alert somebody to who's standing, you know, arm's length away from him to maybe be heads up about that?
You would think. I mean, let's be honest, like, I don't know how they pull this off so successfully every time. Here's what I'm surprised about it. The fact that they don't try it more often and someone, like, deflects the pass. You know, like, gets wind, sees your eyes getting big at the last second and raises their arm up and knocks the pass down or something. The fact that they're always able to get that pass in and catch it and finish cleanly is the most surprising part of it to me. We've seen it stop, like, twice this year where they weren't able to finish or weren't able to catch it cleanly. That shocks me more than the fact that they get it every time.
Yeah, Kenny Freeze, I think, shot like 20% on dumbass plays.
But he just missed the layup. He caught it cleanly.
Exactly. But I mean, it's crazy because half the time JP basically hits the guy in the ear with the pass, and it still ends up getting finished.
JP fires laser passes, by the way. When they do that cross-screen play where he throws it baseline like Reynolds or Farr, he could honestly decapitate a defender if they're not looking, and it happens to catch him in the head. Like, he fires these passes across the court, which I enjoy watching.
JP is such a talented offensive player. Like, just at every he has every club in his bag offensively. Getting to the basket, not only getting to the basket, but he can finish from all kinds of awkward angles.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got that scoop shot. He's got and then he's a great passer too. So it's like, he's such a weapon for them. And in a game like the DePaul game, where Xavier couldn't score for the first 4 or 5 minutes, to have him come off the bench and score, I think, 10 points in the first half, was so huge. And that's just another example of why they're so difficult. And, you know, this will be the last point I make tonight. Somebody posted this, and I can't remember where. I think I saw it maybe on Xavier Hoops, the free message board. But somebody at the Providence game, I guess one of their fans, one of the Xavier fans, overheard them talking, and they said, you know, we may have the two best players on the court in this game, referring to Dunn and Bentel, but Xavier's got, like, 3 through 10. And I think that's true, and that's the way Xavier has been winning games this season.
Probably more like 3 through 13. Go ahead, Doug.
Right, maybe so.
One quick one on Makira. Like, offensive game, obviously, it's there. But why Rick and Dan both know or have a better sense of this, I think, than I do in some ways, because why is it that they essentially have to go to a 1-3-1 to protect JP Makira every time he comes to the game? Even though he's 6'5" and has reasonably long arms and has the skills to be I'm not talking about, like, he's not going to be winning player of the year, but at least be competent to not have to change your entire defensive philosophy to accommodate this guy. Is it just, it's not that, like, his lateral quickness is fast enough to get by guys on the offensive end. That's not really the problem. Is it just that he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in playing any sort of defense? If he's not just being an annoying gnat to top of a 1-3-1.
Well, let me ask you this: Are you saying that he's been bad defensively in the man to man, or are you just saying they always play 1-3-1 when he's in the game?
They seem to play 1-3-1 75% of the time, if not more, when he's in the game. And yep. Initially last year it was to accommodate him. I think at first that was part of the reason they put it in. Just to get him on the floor and not get burned every time. And most of the time now they just stick with it whenever he's on the game.
Yeah. So a few things here. First, I think when they actually developed the 1-3-1, it was after the Providence game last year, the first one, and they were just trying to figure out a way to stop Chris Dunn, basically, because they couldn't guard him. And they're just going to constantly put Stainbrook and ball screens. You couldn't get him on the court. You couldn't have JP on the court. There's a lot of issues last year with being able to match up with Providence and guard Chris Dunn. So and as it turned out, you know, they had those same issues against other teams as well, just to lesser extents. So I think they stayed with the 1-3-1, and they also found out that JP is an asset in the 1-3-1. Instead of being one of your worst defenders in the man-to-man, he's now one of your best defenders in the 1-3-1 because of what he brings: the energy, the length, and the quickness at the top of that going back and forth chasing the passes at the top. So I would start by saying that. And then so last year he was terrible defensively. This year I actually think he's been better man-to-man, and they've asked him to guard some tougher matchups this year too, where he's been more versatile. You know, they're playing the different lineups with Trayvon at the four and him in it there at the same time, and he's had to guard some pretty good wings at different times and done okay. Now, he's never going to be great defensively, one, because I just don't think he's ever put a whole lot of focus and effort on that end. And it's kind of like, you know, if you don't learn the fundamentals of something coming up and you're kind of already set in your ways, like, and you become a Division I scholarship player doing that at a high major college, it's not like they'll make you better. Don't get me wrong. The staff is going to force you to get better. But at the same time, like, are you ever going to be as good as a guy who was about defense? You know, an Alex Barlow type guy who that was his way to survive at the high school levels when you're really learning the game, as opposed to a guy like JP who was just trying to not pick up fouls on the defensive end throughout his entire high school career. So I think that's a big part of it. He's never going to be great defensively, but this year I think he actually has picked it up. He actually is better defensively. The biggest thing I think is that, like you mentioned, like I said before, is that when they go 1-3-1, when he comes into the game, because he's an asset in the 1-3-1, as opposed to just being another guy out there on defense who's guarding the third or fourth best player for the other team. So I think that's it. I don't think they feel like they have to hide him as much. I think they feel like when they go two bigs, they have to go to the 1-3-1. When they want to get extra rebounding or the extra big man in there, they feel they have to go 1-3-1 there. I don't think they feel that they have to go 1-3-1 with JP in the game, but they're just kind of better with him in the 1-3-1. Dan, anything to add on that?
Nope. I think I'm good. I just can't wait to see Chris Mullen and the St. John's Traveling Circus come to town on Wednesday afternoon. 6:30 tip, my favorite.
All right. Doug, anything else there on that to finish up?
No. Thanks for having me.
All right. I think that does it for this edition of the Dane and Victory podcast. For Dan and Doug Tift, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.